The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
We're going to be talking about today is the topic of archaeology in the Bible, which many people are not riveted by, although it actually does have very big implications and has been in the news quite a bit of late. There's articles constantly appearing, even front page articles in major in magazines like Time and Newsweek, dealing with what archaeology does or doesn't say, does it prove, does it not prove. A few months back, during Passover, Rabbi Wolpe of Sinai Temple in Los Angeles got up during the middle of Passover, Chol HaMoed Pesach, and gave a whole vort on it's basically all fiction. Okay, it's interesting, a conservative shul, very interesting. And some people say, some of his congregants said, whether it's true or not doesn't make a difference. But we have to appreciate that the truth of the biblical narrative has huge implications. First of all, theologically, for religion, right? Judaism is based on the fact that there's a Jewish people who left Egypt, who got the Torah at Mount Sinai. If that's a fiction or fairy tale, that has awesome implications for keeping the commandments, being Jewish, secular, whatever. And it also has very strong political implications, because you'll see there's several archaeologists today. It's interesting, the archaeological camp is more or less, it's a little bit of a simplification, but divided into two groups, minimalists and maximalists. Now, probably most of the minimalists and maximalists wouldn't like me using those terms, and there are some people in the middle. But there are those people, like you'll see at the University of Tel Aviv, like Israel Finkelstein and Zev Herzog, who are definitely Israeli minimalists. What they try and do is more or less minimalize the authenticity of the Bible stories. Okay, you have Tom Thompson and some archaeologists at the University of Copenhagen who do the same thing. And the implications of that, we already mentioned theologically, are huge, but also politically. Because if you undermine the Bible stories, you undermine the Jewish people's historical claim to the land of Israel. So it's not just a purely arcane intellectual discussion, what does archaeology say or not say about the Bible? It has implications. Which is why the topic, whereas most people do not get all hot and bothered about archaeology, when you start touching on issues of the Bible and archaeology, the debate becomes often very vitriolic. And people start calling names, precisely because the implications are so tremendous in so many different areas. People start throwing mudslinging at each other, you know. People generally don't get that. I mean, academics often get very emotionally attached to their theories, but precisely because of what's involved in the implications of the theories, we see that it can be very, very intense, the debate. So what I'd like to do is to spend about an hour going through what archaeology is and what it does and doesn't say about the Bible. Okay? So, again, this is not going to be... You're not going to hear anything that's going to blow your socks off. That's not what this is a talk about. But the implications are very important to understand, because people will often hear things said, they'll read articles, and what we need to have is some basic information that allows us, when we see this material, to judge it as objectively as possible. So to begin with, we have to talk about what's the definition of archaeology. So definition of archaeology, anyone want to hazard a guess as to what the definition of archaeology is? Study of ancient what? Of ancient things. That could also be geriatrics. You're close. It's not the exact dictionary definition, but I think it's a pretty accurate one. The discovery and interpretation of the material remains of previous cultures. And let's look at that definition, because it has huge implications. One is the physical discovery, uncovering. Okay, that's the sweaty part. Discovery and interpretation. So the actual digging part, right, that's the part we're familiar with. That's the easy part of archaeology. The hard part is publishing the field reports after. A lot of archaeologists die leaving huge volumes of excavation reports that are never published, precisely because there's so much work involved. But if you look at the second half, I find something, unless it has a label on it, which almost nothing in archaeology comes with a label. This is X, made by so-and-so and such a date. Almost nothing ever comes that way. You then have to interpret what's found. And it's precisely because of this notion of interpretation, this is where a lot of the trouble begins. We're going to see that the two big issues that are going to concern us today are, one is how we interpret what's found, and the second is lack of evidence. Okay, well, let's put lack of evidence on hold, but let's deal with interpretation. Meaning, you find an object, you find a building. What was the building used for? When was it built? By the way, how do we date things in archaeology? It's important to know. Carbon dating works as this potassium argon. There's several different ways of dating. anyone interested, National Geographic this month just did a very interesting article on how old are things, and it gives you all the different kinds of dating and how accurate they are. But rocks are not, you know, carbon dating you can't use for a rock. Dating, the major item used for dating everything in archaeology is pottery shards. Sir Flinders Petrie, about 100 years ago, invented the idea of that every different culture, pottery is a ubiquitous product, every single culture used it, it's like plastic today for their plates, their bowls, everything's pottery. And different cultures use different kinds of pottery. And therefore, when you excavate a site, doing it now the way they do it carefully, in basically stratigraphic, they go down in layers. Each layer you find different kinds of pottery, and you can date different pottery to different periods. Good archaeologists, you can spread out pottery in front of them. They'll say, this is from this period, that's from that period. They won't give you the week it's made. But they'll tell you approximately, based on the kind of pottery, who made it and when it's from. So the pottery that comes with the layer gives you the date. Okay, so that's how we know. So if you dig up a building, okay, you find some pottery. That'll give you a range of maybe even a couple hundred years. What does it mean, though? And this is where the interpretation part gets so tricky. Because depending upon where you're coming from and your theories, that will color exactly how you interpret what's found. There are whole debates between students of different people, like Yigal Yadin and his students, versus other archaeologists, just like Hillel and Shammai students debate for generations. There are archaeologists who have positions that they're very much involved in, and therefore they will always, archaeologist says X, the other archaeologist will always say Y. And a lot of it is ego. But we have to appreciate the interpretation thing is a huge issue in archaeology. There's a very humorous book that came out that every archaeologist I know owns. It's called Motel of Mysteries. It's a spoof on how archaeology works. And the whole, I'll just show you a couple pages from this book. It's very interesting. The whole focus of the book is in the future, an ancient motel, one of those ones with hourly rates, is discovered and excavated. And if you look at the book, it's actually very funny. If you've ever seen archaeology, here they have the pictures, everything is labeled and photographed, and they enter the crypt. It's obviously a motel room we now appreciate. You know, it has, they do all, it's just like an excavation site, you know, carefully, you know. And then what they end up with is they recreate the entire culture based on what they find in this motel room. So here's the picture of the high priestess, okay? It's a woman with a toilet bowl around her head with the sanitary lining they put on a toilet in a motel, less is the band. The great altar, it's pretty funny, is a television set. You know, here they have, here's the worship ceremony. It's very, very humorous, but here it is, the great altar. Arguably, Americans could say the television is the great altar. But the humor behind it, this is a humorous way of showing an interesting point. Most things are open to a tremendous interpretation. Okay, that's number one point. And that interpretation, this is funny, but that interpretation can have much more significant application when you're dealing with archaeology in Israel. For instance, because there's a big battle between, let's say, the ultra-Orthodox Jews and often stopping excavations because they believe they interfere with grave sites, many archaeologists I've interacted with are very anti-religious. Not necessarily for theological reasons, because they've had a lot of bad run-ins. And they view all religious Jews as being closed-minded fanatics, and this will spill over into their interpretation. Now, one classic case I want to read, which is an article. Did I photocopy? I don't know. I don't think I even brought it with me. It's too bad. I'll have to paraphrase it. I thought I had it with me. But in 1990, in November, in the Jerusalem Post, I came across an article on an airplane talking about that they'd found an amphitheater, or theater, I don't remember which one, in Tiberias. Okay, this is in 1990. And the archaeologist said something very interesting. He had about three suppositions. It would have been built. Now, this is built sometime in the first century when the Romans occupied Israel. It probably would have been built at the behest of the local population, meaning majority Jews, who were almost certainly religious. He had a whole bunch of suppositions that had no basis in reality, that the local Jewish population, which was religious, would have requested the Romans build this because they would have wanted this thing. And then he ends with, this shows you that the religious Jews of 2,000 years ago were open-minded and didn't have the ghettoized mentality of today's modern ultra-Orthodox Jews. So besides being based on about three major points of speculation, the guy is also completely blind to the historical realities of Jews under Roman occupation. We know that no people on the planet Earth were less tolerant of Roman occupation than the Jews, which is why the Jews rebelled more than anyone else, which led to the disastrous destruction of the country on numerous occasions. So it's complete nonsense, but it shows you how the idea of interpretation can color how people will read into finds, often to the point of blinding them to the reality. What I'd like to do, okay, so we understand interpretation, the danger of it. What I'd like to do is go, before we look at the actual archaeological evidence, and look at a little of the history behind the archaeology. Like, where is it coming from? We appreciate archaeology as a soft science. Okay, it's not like mathematics. 1 + 1 = 2. It's open to interpretation. It's also not a very old science, especially biblical archaeology. Archaeology in general is something that's relatively new. It's come out of the scientific revolution of the last couple hundred years. Okay, it didn't exist thousands of years ago. One of the problems we have as archaeologists today, if you're one, is that people in the ancient world, not caring about what existed previously, would destroy structures that today would be priceless because they didn't care about preserving it. They just wanted to reuse the stones or reuse the space. So we have basically a new science which came out of a period of European history which was called the Enlightenment. And if you know what's going on in Europe in the 19th century, you know the Enlightenment. The whole focus of the Enlightenment in Europe was rationalism, empirical science, understanding things logically. Okay? Religion was definitely looked at with a bit of disdain at this period of time as being an intellectual cop-out. Let's understand things scientifically. Out of Enlightenment thinking will come a whole school of thought called Bible criticism. People heard of Bible criticism? Which is an attempt to understand who really wrote the Bible based on the assumption that it's not written by God, which is a big break with what people believed for hundreds, if not thousands of years. The Bible's the Word of God. So Bible critics come along. The number one Bible critic in the 19th century is a German by the name of Julius Wellhausen. Okay, and in the late 19th century, he published a theory called the documentary hypothesis concerning the authorship of the Bible, which is not our topic, but which is the backbone of all Bible criticism today. Now, Wellhausen, as a scholar, had to base his theory on... His basic theory was... Let me just talk about it for a minute so we understand where archaeology fits in. His basic theory is the Bible was put together much later in history, not 3,300 years ago. Okay, none of this Jews wandering the desert stuff like we mentioned in Seven Wonders when we were talking. Right? Sorry? No, it's the late 19th century. The actual theory comes out in 1878, Documentary Hypothesis. The German name is really long-winded. It's everything in German. Like 12 words in English is like 2 words in German. So it's the exact name in German. I'll have to give you the title later. It's called the Documentary Hypothesis. It's the JEPDNR theory, if anyone's heard of it. Okay. His basic assumption was that everything that happens in the early texts of the Bible in Genesis is all myths and fairy tales. It was like romantic folklore passed down by ancient Semitic peoples, but rather much later in history, not 3,300 years ago, like the traditional Jewish date for the Exodus and Moses and wandering in the desert and him writing the book down, but rather between 2,900 and 2,500 years ago, these rabbis and priests, over a period of several hundred years, got together, collected these myths and fairy tales, put them together in a book, claimed it was the Word of God, and foisted it on the Jewish people. But there's no historicity to it. Okay, when I say historicity, there's nothing tangible. It's sort of fiction. What was he basing it on? Okay, what's the only sort of outside verification for this theory that he could find? Archaeology. The problem was that in the late 19th century, there's virtually no archaeology related to the Bible. In the late 19th century, that's when the Turks had Israel. Archaeology only becomes a big thing in the ancient Near East when the British get a hold of it. There are excavations here, but when the British get a hold of the territory, then it becomes a huge thing. Okay? So he was basically basing his evidence on, because we have not found archaeological finds that support the biblical narrative, the Bible stories, ergo est, as we'd say in Latin, therefore the stories aren't true. It's exactly. What was he basing it on? Lack of evidence, which, by the way, is an extremely dangerous thing to do. In a court of law, lack of evidence is no proof of anything. This is a very important point. This is the most important point we need to focus on in the debate in archaeology and the Bible. Just because I don't find a piece of evidence to show us, you know, the footprints of the Jews wandering in the desert or, you know, Joseph's signature on an ancient Egyptian document does not prove he doesn't exist. Okay. As to why we don't find that evidence, we'll deal with in a minute. So he said that lack of archaeological evidence, even though almost nothing was found back then, in either way, led him to jump to a conclusion, which we now know is very, you know, doesn't hold water the way it did over 100 years ago. But not only that, he also claimed that since the authors would be writing about events that happened much, much earlier, and remember that 2,800 years ago or so, there was no libraries you could go to. If you want to write a historical novel about, let's say, you know, Rome 2,000 years ago, what would you do to write the novel? Yeah, you go to Rome, you'd visit the sites, you'd go through lots of history books, okay? You'd learn about the culture and the dress and the food and the buildings and the... Otherwise, if you write in your book, you know, you're talking about ancient Rome, when you talk about Caesar took a helicopter to Greece, you know, people are going to look at you like, that's what's that called? A helicopter in ancient Rome 2,000 years ago? An anachronism. Okay? You can actually date books. You can date things by when, like, how would you know when the earliest period of time that book could have been written was? If you read a book about Rome and helicopters, ancient Rome, you just go, the earliest helicopter that ever existed, you know, the book had to have been written past that date. Unless it was Leonardo da Vinci who thought of the helicopter in theory many hundreds of years before anyone else made one. But it would still be much later in time. So people see what he's doing? This is basically where the world was coming from. So the initial approach of archaeology, to a large extent, and scholars towards the Bible and archaeology was based on this biblical theory, etc., that it's more or less myths and fairy tales. Now, there's a couple problems with that. What we're going to basically go into in a few minutes is what the evidence does show us. But let's look at a few of the problems we have with using that. Well, first of all, we understand that lack of evidence is no evidence of lack proves nothing. But more importantly than that, even today, even though we have many archaeological sites, only a teeny tiny percentage. In Israel, there are literally thousands and thousands of archaeological sites, of whom the majority have never been touched. And even the sites that have been excavated, if you've been to Megiddo, Hatzor, virtually any place, even Ir David, right here, the city of David, only small sections of those sites have been excavated. And there is the only site I know that's been completely excavated in Israel. Anyone know the only site that's pretty much been excavated down to bedrock in the whole country? Sorry? Masada. It's the only site I know in the country where every square inch of it has been excavated down to the mesa. But everywhere else, they're the top of the plateau that it sits on. Everywhere else is more or less... hold on a second. What we're left with is therefore maybe 2-3% of that which could be excavated has actually been excavated. I think 3% is probably way too high. Okay, teeny tiny fraction. So to jump to conclusions based on such a small excavation, and certainly 100 years ago when nothing was excavated, was a much bigger problem. You had a question? Yeah.
Just very quickly, I know we're discussing interpretation. Let's just go back to the discovery. How does it work that one civilization culture builds on another? You say that the big problem was in the old days it was destroyed. I'm saying how else do you build?
No, today, nowadays, because we appreciate, like today, in the Jewish quarter, there are whole areas of the Jewish quarter that have never been built on top of, or excavated and built on top of, to preserve the sites. Because today we value ancient sites. I'm saying that if people in the ancient world decided that for some reason they were going to value some ancient site, they would not build on it. Basically, what you find in Israel is a unique feature of the Near Eastern archaeology, which is called tell archaeology. You guys know what a tell is? A tell is an artificial mound caused by successive layers of civilization. And it's generally why you find it in the Middle East, because the Middle East, when you're not building by rivers, usually, okay, you're building next to a spring, you have to remain close to that spring. So when you build your city on top of a previously destroyed civilization, you just build right on top and on top and on top. You make a stairway or an elaborate water system that goes down into the tell to the base of the spring, which is why if anyone's been to Beit Sha'an, you see an amazing tell, almost 200 feet high, that contains 13 different layers of civilization that go back way, 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 way close to, I believe, the bottom layers of civilization are over 5,000 years old. Okay? In Beit Sha'an. Okay? So that's the tell archaeology. So basically, you have one level of civilization on top of another. Usually, the previous civilization is destroyed. Whatever is usable is reused. Okay?
You're saying they'll destroy the building,
but... Well, the building, often, whatever is, they'll just build on top, use it as a base. Or they'll reuse the stones. Generally, the buildings are destroyed in siege, or they just loot the place, dump the buildings, build on top of it. You do have reusing structures, but generally not. Okay, so we understand, A, subjectivity, B, lack of evidence, C, the idea that so little has been excavated, it's so dangerous. Scientific theory is, you know, scientific theory, how it works? Something's a theory, it doesn't become a fact. It just becomes the current accepted theory based on the evidence. So if you get new evidence, you're supposed to change the theory. So this is, we have an example of a theory which is based on very little excavated evidence. Now, we now living over 130 years after the documentary hypotheses, although we haven't seen even 10% of what exists that could be excavated, at least have a much broader sample that we can use to come to some conclusions about what you're going to look at in a second. And, of course, the other thing that makes it so difficult, as I mentioned before, to decide, interpret how you find, is so little of what we found is literary. Everyone appreciate that a written document is of infinite more value? Yeah, obviously, you find like a beautiful gold. You know, most archaeology is not finding beautiful coins and statues. The vast majority of archaeology is hours of sweat and filth and dirt and tons of pottery shards and structures. the remains of the foundations of buildings. And occasionally you find something interesting, an oil lamp or this. And what's the best thing to find? A written document, in terms of not necessarily the most valuable, but in terms of what can give you information, written documents. There have been many places in the ancient Near East and places like Iraq today, cities named like, you know, Nuzi, Ebla, Alalak, places like that, where they found royal libraries of ancient civilizations, archives, okay, which are often, and what do people write on in the ancient world? They wrote on, first of all, you have papyrus, which generally doesn't last. The amazing thing about the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are over 2,000 years old, is that they are not papyrus, and they're made from the plant, but they are, they're from animal cloth, which is animal hide. But because they were buried in a place which was virtually no rain and very low humidity, they survived for 2,000 years. Generally, written documents on either papyrus or on animal skin didn't survive. What survives? Inscriptions engraved in stone, obviously. That which is written on broken pieces of pottery called ostraca. Okay, monuments, that's very good. That's the stuff that's mostly found. Engraved documents, cuneiform tablets, clay tablets that were engraved with a stylus and then heated in an oven like a pot you do in a kiln. So that we have stuff from. But the problem is in Israel, we found no archives have ever been found in this country from any civilization. It's ironic that the most literate people in human history, the Jews, has never been found in royal archives here and anywhere around here. So that only adds to the confusion because written documents go a long way. They're much less subject to interpretation because it's right there to read. Doesn't mean they're not subject to any interpretation, but it's right there. So we understand what we're going through now. We understand what archaeology is, the discovery and interpretation. Interpretation is subjective. Very little has been found today. Okay, people are jumping to conclusions, often colored by their personal or political opinions. So we understand where it was coming from, a sort of negative view that the archaeology is fairy tale. What I'd like to do now is basically look at some of the examples that we see in archaeology and see what they do or don't prove. Now, we have to distinguish, by the way, between pieces of archaeology that prove things in the Bible, pieces of archaeology that disprove things in the Bible, or maybe pieces of archaeology that are circumstantial evidence. So we have to define our terms here. One thing's for sure, there is virtually no archaeology that disproves the Bible. This is very important to understand. Okay? One thing to say we have no evidence for something. It's another thing to say I found a document or some piece of archaeology that conclusively disproves something in the Bible. Such things we don't have. Okay? Many things that were thought to be anachronistic and dated in the Bible we now appreciate, in fact, are not. Okay? Do people see that? That's a very important point, number one. So we have things that disprove basically don't exist. Things that directly prove the Bible. I mean, no, there's a few examples of things that might possibly be considered still anachronistic but really aren't. Like a classic case is talking about Abraham from Ur Kasdim. The Chaldeans, people say, lived after Abraham. Does that mean they didn't live before? Maybe that was the name of the place. It's a very weak. There's really no direct. There's nothing really attacking the Bible per se. All the attack is coming from lack of evidence. Why don't we find? Why don't we find evidence of the Jews in Egypt? Why don't we find evidence of the Exodus? If Joseph was such an important guy, why don't Egyptian royal records mention him? The plague, so amazing. The Egypt was destroyed. The sea splitting, what an amazing miracle. Why wasn't that front page headlines in every, you know? Do people see that? Those are good questions. Why don't we find footprints of 3 million Jews walking through the desert for 40 years? A little campfire, some empty Coke bottles, you know? Okay, so that's what I want to talk about. That's basically what I want to mention now.
How would the rest of the world know, apart from where the Jews were?
Okay, so let's deal with the question of what we find and don't find and why not. As to the issue of why we don't find evidence, that goes to a much bigger point. First of all, maybe it's there and we haven't found it. That's number one. It just could be a lack of evidence case. Number two, like why don't the Egyptians talk about the plagues? What an amazing event. Egypt humbled by 10 supernatural plagues. Can you imagine today? Look what happened, you know, 2 days ago with the World Trade Center. Virtually, that was probably the most watched event in the history of television. Everyone knows about it immediately. Okay? No matter, you think America can hide it because they're embarrassed about the total failure of, you know, the security at the airports and the intelligence didn't know there was an incredibly organized terror. I mean, think about it. In the ancient world, this is exactly what the answer would have been yes. You would never hear about it. Why? We have to appreciate that history, okay, just like archaeology, history is older than archaeology, but it's not as old as the archaeology in the Bible. The first historian in the West is a guy by the name of Herodotus, a Greek, who wrote in the 5th century. And he wasn't even objective, albeit no historian is truly objective. Like they say, not even God can change history, only historians can. But at least attempts to be objective in history begin around the time of like 2,400 or so years ago. The stories in the Bible, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they're taking place in the 18th century BCE, 1,300 years prior to that. There are no archaeology at all. There's no history. And believe it or not, we today are very interested in our past. Many, many cultures in the ancient world for many, many, many centuries had no interest in recording the past. Because they just didn't view it. It's not a change in attitude. It was just something that the Greeks, who were so interested in categorizing and describing everything, they got into. Okay? But records were kept. Obviously, people need to record things. Laws were written down. Doesn't mean we can't piece together. We can piece together historical records based largely on archaeology. But in the ancient world, the very ancient world, talking about pre-Greek, not the classical world, Greece and Rome kept historical records, albeit almost sometimes quite biased, but they at least made attempts. They wouldn't rewrite history totally. They just put a different slant on it. In the ancient world, what do we find is recorded? No one sat down and wrote at the time of Abraham a book about the history of ancient Canaan. And happens to mention this guy Abraham was a big guy and had a lot of money and a prophet of God and wandered around. That would be great if we found that, but we don't. Because people just weren't interested in writing that. But yet, if you go to like ancient Egypt, the Karnak, you see there are giant commemorative inscriptions. If you go to the British Museum, you can see the whole walls of Sennacherib's palace from Nineveh, the Assyrian emperor. Right? From the 8th century BCE. Sennacherib, the emperor of Assyria, who happened to besiege Jerusalem. Remember Sennacherib, the story? It's in the British Museum. The British pillaged everything from everyone. They did. They pillaged all the archaeology from all these countries. If you look at these inscriptions, if you look at Pharaoh going into war as inscribed in Karnak, it's amazing. Pharaoh, by the way, is 20 times larger than everyone else. The Egyptians are totally victorious. There are no dead Egyptians. The enemy is being slaughtered. Their heads are lying everywhere. You look at the Sennacherib inscriptions from his palace in Nineveh, which, by the way, deal with the siege of Lachish, south of Jerusalem, when he was on his way to come to Jerusalem and besiege it. You can see the siege of the city, there are dead Jews, there are dead Jews impaled on wooden spikes and piles of heads and people being executed and paying tribute to him. There are no dead Assyrian soldiers anywhere. What's the point? The purpose of that inscription was not to record anything accurately. It was to glorify the emperor. No one had any interest 3,000 years ago in being accurate. Anyone who did wouldn't have lived too long. Okay? You're being paid by the emperor to inscribe the walls of his palace so you can impress the queen. Who knows what it's for? Okay, so there's no way in the planet Earth that anyone in ancient Egypt would have recorded the plagues. Now there is a papyrus called the Ipuwar papyrus, which is dated to approximately that period of time, which does mention events that sound similar to the plagues. Could it be? Maybe. Can I say for sure? No. I'd rather not, as we say in Jewish terminology, tafasta maruba. To go the other way and make ridiculous claims about what archaeology does prove is equally negative. Like, great example. These are some good ones here. Look at this one here. Goliath's skull found in Holy Land. Here's the skull. Here's the rock in the skull. Here it is. Adam and Eve's skeleton found in Colorado. I guess they were on a ski trip. Okay, this is also totally nonsense. Okay, the point is you don't want to go either way to extremes. One should not jump to extreme conclusions in either way. This is, of course, a joke. But if we understand the complete lack of interest in history at this period of time, the complete lack of in preserving anything ancient, we appreciate why we don't find evidence from these events. No one would record them. By the way, you should know as a side point, guys, you should appreciate the Bible is unique among ancient documents for being critical. Israel Zangwill, who's a British Zionist writer, over 100 years ago, I'm paraphrasing him, but he basically said, either the Bible is written by God or an anti-Semite. Because Israel is the villain. We're always being like picked apart for all the mistakes we make. That, by the way, is very unusual. So you talk about objectivity, the Bible is, as to why, I don't want to go into it, it's outside the scope of this course. But the purpose of the Bible is obviously not to stroke the national ego of the Jewish people, unlike all of these inscriptions you see in Egyptian and Assyrian and Babylonian temples. He may be. He might be there somewhere. We don't know what name he used. And maybe, okay, he was a big guy. If Joseph was Pharaoh and he had a specific name, then we'd have a more interesting question. Okay. But we're going to talk about what we do find in Egypt now. I'd like to, yeah.
So the oldest archaeological evidence dates back only to the
Sennacherib? No, no, no. There's archaeological evidence going all the way back. As early as civilization begins, the earliest Aryan habitation is Jericho in Israel, the earliest city they call it, which goes back way before that. Okay, calcolithic. It's not a question that there's no archaeological evidence. It's that there. I'm just giving you great examples of known events in human history, but how one side records them. Were the Assyrians victorious at Lachish? Yes. Did they lose men in the battle? Of course they did. Okay. So, but now, by the way, once we get to, and we'll talk about this later, when we get to a certain period of time in Jewish history, we have direct correlation to things in the Bible. We will see that. But early on, you know, early on in the patriarchal period, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, that Exodus story, we don't find anything. And again, combination of the total disinterest in people at preserving their events, recording them accurately, and just not finding things that might be that we haven't found yet, doesn't lead us to any conclusions, one way or another. Sorry?
Surely we should find 2 million.
So why don't we find, first of all, in the desert, why don't we find evidence of the Exodus? Okay, so it's a great, there's a great example. First of all, the Bible itself talks about it being supernatural in terms of people's clothes didn't wear out, the food came from, you know, supernaturally, the water, people died. Okay, so where are they buried? We don't know. What's the route? I have no idea. How in the world, if you knew, if someone said, here is the definitive map of where the Jewish people wandered for 40 years, and you could walk along it and try looking for bodies, but since we don't even know where the route was, how would you find anything there? Bedouin campsites from 40 years ago you won't find remains of, unless you know where to look. You're talking about 3,000 years ago. Again, it's another example of lack of evidence is no evidence of lack. So what I'd like to do now is, let's look at some of the evidence. So we already talked about contradictory evidence doesn't exist. Direct evidence for early events in the Bible, when I say early, patriarchal period up through about, let's say, the 9th century BCE, past David and Solomon, before David and Solomon and before, we have a problem with, we'll see right now. After that, we do have direct evidence. So direct evidence for like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Exodus, we don't have. What we do have is a large body of what's called circumstantial evidence. And for the text of the Bible. And what I'd like to show you now is what that evidence is. Okay? And with the conclusions we can therefore draw from it. Now, you ever know what circumstantial evidence is? Anyone know lawyers here? What's circumstantial evidence? It's indirect proof. Now, in a court of law, in American law, is circumstantial evidence admissible? 100% it is. You can get a conviction or an acquittal on circumstances, especially if there's no direct evidence, especially if you build up a significant enough case. All the circumstances surrounding the actions show clearly, blah, 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 and there's nothing contradicting it. So we do have a lot of circumstantial evidence. Sorry? Jewish law is a separate thing, but I'm just trying to say that in Western law, and it doesn't... Okay. So let's look at some of the circumstantial evidence, and then I want to deal with an issue which is related to what we... the power of circumstantial evidence when dealing with the Bible. Okay, a few things. One of the things that was used for years is a classic case of how the Bible's anachronistic, meaning it uses things that weren't in use at the time, but only much later, is the domesticated camel. Remember Abraham sends Eliezer with the camels, right? Okay, you know the story. Okay, archaeologists, going back a number of years, said we don't find evidence of domesticated camels that early on. Therefore, the writer who lived much later in history assumed that they had camels earlier. Ergo est, therefore, it is an anachronism. We now appreciate that, in fact, domesticated camels were used in the time of Abraham and before that. So there's a great case of something that was thought to be wrong, which was not, and used as an attack against the Bible, which we now know not only to be correct, but it means the author knows that domesticated camels, whoever the author is, are being used at that time. He's got the right technology. Okay. The tale of Joseph. Okay. The sale of Joseph is described. The price is paid for Joseph. 20 pieces of silver. Now, here's another great case. Today, if you say, you know, that I remember when I was a little kid, my haircuts when I was a little kid were 75 cents. Okay, this is not 1,000 years ago. Now, if you told someone today, in 2001, you know, I just had a haircut, I go, great, how much was it? You'd expect to hear, what's the price in New York to pay for a haircut? That's cheap. That's very cheap. You go to a cheap barber. That's a firm barber. You got like a hair salon, a stylist, you know. It's not a garbage man. He's a sanitation engineer. He's not a barber. He's a stylist or a hair designer. You'll pay $25, $30, $40. If you tell someone you got a haircut for 75 cents in New York in 2001, they'll think you're out of your mind. Which means that even prices of items within a lifetime changed tremendously. Now, the 20 pieces of silver paid for Joseph, we now know through archaeology, for that period of time, was the going rate for a price of a slave. Meaning what? Who's ever writing the book has access to that information. It's correct for that period of time. It's like writing your historical novel. Sorry, because we now find records that are dated to that period of time, which give slave prices. Okay? Kenneth Kitchen, the archaeologist, brings that up. Names, by the way, names are an excellent example. For instance, sorry?
Can you just clarify what that means exactly?
It means the author knows the price of an item at the right period of time. Price has changed throughout history.
Sorry?
If you're writing it like, 1941, a guy went into a barber and paid $45 for a haircut. That was like most people's monthly wage. You know what I mean? If you didn't know the price of... Okay, I'm saying the author, whoever he is, knows what the price of things are for the right period of time. That's circumstantial proof for the accuracy of the story. It doesn't mention Joseph anywhere being sold as a slave. Are we following what I'm saying? Okay, there's a papyrus called the Brooklyn Papyrus. Okay? That's because it's kept in the Brooklyn Museum. If you want to go see it, for those of you from Brooklyn. And on it is, it's a document from Egypt, dated from the period of time of the, which would be the period of time Jews were slaves in Egypt, which gives names. Okay, it gives names like Asher, Yisachar, Shifra, names that appear in the Bible. Okay, parallel names. Are we saying it's the same Asher as the Asher in the Bible? No. But it means the author, whoever he is, has what? The right names for the right period of time. This is also important. We don't appreciate it today. Today, most people don't name their kids, Ethel and Morris. In America today, names go in and out of vogue very, very rapidly. You can see that the names used in the United States 100 or 200 years ago are very different from the names used today. Again, if it was written much later in time, you'd expect to find names from a much later period in time, right? Thrown back into the novel. For instance, an extreme example, Abraham, Isaac, and Steve. That's an extreme example. We don't find that. So again, who the author is, we got the right names for the right period of time. Nothing anachronistic there. It also mentions in the Bible that the Jews, when they were slaves in Egypt, and by the way, the Exodus, the Pharaoh generally connected with the Exodus is Ramses II in the New Kingdom of Egypt. Egypt being a very old civilization going back, existing for over 3,000 years. The Pharaoh that fits most closely is probably Ramses II. And we know Ramses was a great builder. He didn't build the pyramids, by the way. Pyramids were built way before the Jews ever came to Egypt. Yeah, 100%. But archaeologists found, it says, what does it say the Jews built? Remember in Egypt they built? They built Pitom v'Ramses. So those cities have in fact been found, built during the reign of Ramses II. So we have a description of what the Jews built. We go to the place built at the same period of time as the Jews were there, and sure enough, we find those cities being there. It also mentions the Exodus route. If you look in Maaseh, Parshas Maaseh, it gives the route that the Jews traveled on, mentioning specific locations. Archaeologists for years claimed that those locations were anachronistic. They didn't exist at the time of Egypt. And then, lo and behold, in three different sites in Egypt, including the temple in Karnak, they found similar lists giving the same cities, maybe slightly different pronunciations, but very, very close, and even in the same order. Where, for instance, where it gives the names Eim, Divon, right? Almon, Nivo, Abel Shittim, the names that are mentioned in the Bible are found on the Egyptian records, which means those places existed. Okay, the Egyptians record them simultaneous to when the Jews were recording them. Again, here's a great example. Places that exist today didn't necessarily exist hundreds, not thousands of years ago. Like if you're making a list of ancient cities in America or locations, you put Manhattan, New York. We have you list a bunch of Indian names, and you put Manhattan and the ancient whatever Indians went up Fifth Avenue, and they obviously we see the point. If those places didn't exist back then, and the author threw them in back in time, they'd be anachronistic. So there's another example. Again, means whoever the author is, he's got the right places for the right period of time. Nothing anachronistic. We see what we're doing here. None of this is direct evidence. Nowhere does it say for sure. It doesn't say in the Egyptian temples that this is the route the Jews took when fleeing Egypt. But it does show that the author, whoever he is listing real places. Okay, contrary to what was believed about them. Okay, Jericho. Here's another classic case. Jericho has been used, by the way, for years as a great example of how the Bible isn't correct. Because Kathleen Kenyon, who was a great British woman archaeologist who dug here primarily in the 1950s, she dug in Jericho and didn't find evidence of inhabitation of the city at the time when the Jews were supposed to have conquered it. Meaning that there was no city there at the time. It's anachronistic. Okay, now by the way, there's two different takes on Jericho. Archaeologists that I've spent time with, like Avner Gorin, claim that in fact there is clear evidence that there was inhabitation from that period of time. Rather, because you find in the in the washes. You know, Jericho is a natural spring. There's a flooding area there. You find around the city, not in the excavation, the tell itself, but clear remains from that period of time have been washed away, meaning that area of inhabitation that would have existed, because what did people build with back then? You know how things were built going back 3,000 years? Exactly. They would build, the bottom stones of walls would be rock, and the rest would be mud brick, and then plastered. Okay, you think they didn't build all rock stone cities. That's very, mud brick is much easier. Take mud, you make it into bricks, it's quite strong, but it doesn't last, meaning much of it was washed away. There's also Professor Bryant Wood of University of Toronto who actually claims that if you re-examine the evidence and dig in a different place, because that's one of the problems with archaeology, I dig over here, I don't find anything, I come to a conclusion. Now, the site could be 100,000 times larger than the little site, and archaeologists are working with a limited budget, right? Digs can take, and yet it's very tedious work. So generally, you could, a site might be something, on a site that could, I kid you not, on a site that could be 30, 40 acres in size, archaeologists might actually only dig on a piece that would be maybe twice the size of this room and spend 4 or 5 years digging in that place. Because it's tedious, slow work, they have limited budgets, then they might run out of money, and they might, why do they pick where they pick on a tell? Based on how cities are laid out, they pick a location where they think they'll find something interesting. But they could easily miss something. So Professor Bryant Wood of University of Toronto says, you know, if you in fact move over and look in this spot over here, we find clear evidence of inhabitation, clear evidence of siege and destruction. He even takes the story to the other extreme and shows that exactly what's found there matches the biblical account perfectly. The New York Times picked up on this about 10 years ago. They did a whole story, that they're like religious people score in the battle over Jericho. You know, it's very funny, like a basketball game. Okay. Another great example. It says when the Jewish people come into the land of Israel, we just read the story, right? They cross the Jordan, they put the 12 stones in the Jordan River with the Torah on it, and they go to Shechem, where Joseph is buried, which is today Nablus, which has two mountains, one on either side. One is named Har Gerizim, the other one's Har Eval. What are you supposed to do? They do this whole elaborate thing with the curses and the blessings, and what do they put on top of Har Eval? They built a Mizbeach, an altar. Okay? Adam Zertal, who's the head of the Department of Archaeology at the University of Haifa, has in fact found an altar with the correct dimensions right on the top of Har Eval, dated to the right period of time. Interestingly enough, there are no animal bones from non-kosher animals found at the site. There are bones, but only kosher animals. Okay, is this the altar? Can we say definitively? No. If it had like an inscription, altar built by Joshua in commemoration of Jews crossing the land of Israel and fulfillment of the commandment in the Bible in Deuteronomy chapter, blah, 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 blah. That would have been great. That would have been a total knockout. All the minimalists would be out of work in 2 hours if they found something like that. But they find an altar. It fits. It could well be. Can we say definitively? No. But it's a very nice piece of circumstantial evidence. It's actually a little more than circumstantial. It's approaching direct.
What did they say to the people?
Other archaeologists, like people like Zev Chanafitz, I don't know if they dealt with it directly, but most of them, they'll disregard it. It doesn't mean that. It could be from a different period of time. You can't say that conclusively. Not necessarily because they have evidence that contradicts it, but because their whole point of view goes against that. And once you know cognitive dissonance works? Once you, like if I have a pen that costs a dollar and you have a pen that costs a dollar, and I tell you my pen is better. So most people aren't emotionally attached to a dollar pen. Maybe I'll convince you, you'll go trade yours in or buy another one. If you have a $24,000 car and I have a $24,000 car, that's a little bit more investment. You're not so likely to hear me attacking your car and take it sitting down. You just spent a lot of money to buy that car. You may not be open to hearing the criticism, even if it's legitimate. Now, if it's my entire life and my reputation is in a theory, and I speak on it, and I bid papers on it, and everyone knows me for it, and my entire identity and self-worth is wrapped up in what I'm doing in this theory, how likely do you think I'm going to be, if you come along and tell me I'm wrong, to listen? It takes a truly idealistic, intellectual human being to say, you know what? You're right. I'm going to dump my theory. Okay. Most scholars in history are not willing to do that. So which means that people, I've seen archaeologists take the exact same object and come to completely different conclusions about it, and it often has nothing to do with their theories, but with ego. Because this is what you're. It's unbelievable. You know, people have to appreciate how much is wrapped up in this. Yeah. Any other questions?
Yeah. Before 1900
BC, there was not much history. For the 5th century, Herodotus is the first historian in the Greek. Right. Right. BCE, exactly.
So in that case, if they're saying that the Bible was written over periods, how would the author have the information?
Okay, so you're asking how would the author have the information? So let's leave that on hold. Okay, that's an excellent question. I'm going to get to...
going to get to that at the end. Okay. One more question? Oh yeah, they try. Oh no, people like people like Israel Finkelstein have published whole books and theories showing that the biblical narrative is nonsense based on their findings. But if you read what their findings are, which by the way are way out there and extreme, and almost no archaeologists hold with them, it's not direct evidence of any kind. And there are people, and you can find other archaeologists like an Adam Zertal. And Israel Finkelstein, the guy who found the altar at Mount Ebal, would completely disagree. And they'd present other evidence to show you the exact opposite. And the point is, what's true? And we're going to get to this whole idea of like what we can... In the end, I'll conclude what I think is a realistic approach to archaeology. Yeah?
I just want to understand, we were learning earlier this week, we had a big week.
Yeah.
We were learning earlier this week an idea of the fossil record and the lack of the fossil record... proving microevolution,
yeah,
using it as a proof that microevolution doesn't work
right
that way.
Right.
And here you're saying you can't use lack of evidence as a proof.
No, but that's different. That's different because it's a good question. Microevolution, because they didn't find transitional forms, okay, that means they had to change the theory so now you have punctuated equilibrium, for instance, which is held by Stephen Jay Gould at Harvard. That's different because they are talking about literally finding millions of pieces of paleontology. Okay, that's based on looking at a massive amount of paleontology and saying, and not finding any of them, okay, versus looking at a teeny tiny sample and finding nothing to support, which is what archaeology is. The difference is huge, which is why archaeologists still stick to their guns, but why people involved in evolutionary theory have to change the theory. Because it's one thing, when Darwin published his theory of evolution in 1858, he said, the problem with my theory is we've yet to find the transitional forms, but I'm sure in the future we will. Which is okay to speculate scientifically on a theory based on, I don't know the evidence yet, but I'm sure we'll find it. But then, when you go to 100 years later and no one's found any of the forms, and they've since looked at tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of remains, of organic remains, and not found any of it, so then they have to change the theory. Okay, so there is a difference. You're right. It seems on the surface to be similar. Okay, let's keep going and look at a few more pieces of evidence. It says in the book of Jeremiah, it talks about the Philistines being from Crete. Okay, by the way, no, which is, we appreciate the Philistines are a feast, the Philistines, not related to the Goldsteins. Seafaring people who lived on the coast of Israel. Okay, we now appreciate that piece of information to be correct. Okay, it has, whoever the author is, the Philistines are extinct going back many thousands of years. But again, the author knows the origin of the Philistines. It also mentions, talk about the Philistines, if you look in Samuel, in chapter 13, it talks about how the Philistines controlled the making and sharpening of iron tools. And how the Jews would come and give them to sharpen their tools a pim, which we'd spell in, it has a Hebrew spelling, pim, and P-Y-M in English. No one knew for literally years and years and years what is a pim. Okay, that was the payment you'd pay to have your sickle sharpened. And then sure enough, they found a little metal weight measure, which had inscribed on it, pim. It was like the standard token you'd use to pay a metalsmith to sharpen your tools. So here you have a description of something very, very specific. It's like a nickel. Right? You know like the word nickel? A dime? And it's funny. If you come from America, you know nickels and dimes are in quarters. My wife from England, she goes to America. She has no idea what the money is. It's like what used to be in England, a farthing, a shilling, a pence, a quid. These are all terms that are specific to currencies at a very specific period of time, which would involve the author knowing very minute details of the culture. Now we find through archaeology such a thing existed at exactly that period of time. They find the item itself. It's very, very interesting. They also find when digging in the land of Israel, in the settlement for the period from the 13th to the 11th century, they find a huge increase in settlement in the land. Now, what would the 13th to 11th centuries correspond to in the biblical history?
BCE,
yeah, excuse me. What would it correspond to? The period of, by the way, a huge, I would say, unnaturally large increase in settlement in Israel. What would that correspond to? What's happening in that period of time? The Jews entering the land of Israel and settling in there. So sure enough, the Bible describes something, and they find physical evidence which seems to bear that out. Does it prove conclusively it was Jews? Do they find houses with mezuzahs on them, and menorahs, and sfarim in there, and here's my set of Gomorrahs, okay? No, obviously they don't, but it fits. If it were to claim that huge amounts of Jews came into the land at that period of time and you would dig all over the place and find no area of a settlement, you have a good question. Where's the evidence? It also mentions that King Solomon, when he built his chariot cities, Chatzor, Megiddo, Gezer, It mentions them in the Book of Kings. And sure enough, we find these three cities. These are well-known archaeological sites. There's a little bit of debate around the age of some of the structures in the city. But more or less, we find cities with similar layout, similar gates, similar walls, similar water systems, pretty much dated for the right period of time. So you have a biblical description of what King Solomon's doing. You find evidence that supports it. Okay? What else? A little more direct evidence up in Tel Dan. You remember the Tel Dan? It's one of the sources of the Jordan River. Okay, it's a very ancient city site there. Also the site where we know that Yerovam ben Nevat built the altar when he split away from the southern kingdom. They find the altar, by the way. It's there. You ever been there? It's really cool. The base of the altar site built by Yerovam is actually there. Okay, that's interesting. But more interesting, one of the big debates that's focused on when looking in the Book of Kings is the myth. It's actually in Samuel and Kings, is the myth of this great monarchy of David and Solomon. The Bible describes David as being this great warrior king who subdues all the nations around him and builds this huge empire. And then Solomon, Jerusalem sounds like a major cosmopolitan center, right? Big palaces and a huge temple complex and a huge empire. And where is the evidence for that? We don't even find evidence for David and Solomon anywhere. Okay, their names aren't even mentioned, these archaeologists were saying. They didn't exist. It's mythological. It's like King Arthur. You've heard of King Arthur's Knights of the Round Table? That's basically a myth that was used by King Alfred. We're talking about early medieval king of England, resurrected the Arthur myth as a way of strengthening the power of central authority in England. When England was, there's no strong central monarchs in early medieval Europe. England was one of the first countries to emerge with those things. Okay, so the early kings of Israel had this myth of David and Solomon. So by the way, two things. One is they found. There's two places that have been found since then where Beit David is mentioned. You know, today the royal family of England is called the House of Windsor. Okay? So the royal family of the Jewish people is called Beit David. Okay? The House of David. So first of all, Avraham Biran, up in Tel Dan, who's, I think he recently passed away. He was very old. He was in his 90s. He's been digging in Tel Dan for like 30, 40 years. He found in secondary use, meaning an inscription that was from something earlier and then reused. People will often just take the blocks, even inscriptions, even coffins, sarcophagi, and put them in walls as building material. He found an inscription from Hatzal, the Syrian king, talking about, it's a victory inscription, but it mentions Beit David. Beit David. It's pretty interesting. This was a whole big explosion in the archaeological war when it came out a number of years ago. And there's dots between the Dalet, Vav, Dalet. And almost everyone agrees that it's Beit David. But some of the extremists say it's Beit Dod, the house of the uncle. It's an abbreviation. Okay, but almost virtually all scholars agree this is direct evidence. Not that it's King David. It's not King David. Hatzalah, if you read the story in the Bible, is after King David. But it proves that there was such a thing as the royal family of the house of King David. There must have been a David. Okay? They also found in the Moabite stone. It's in the Louvre. The Moabite, Moabite stone. It's called the Mesha stone. They also find an inscription, also dealing with the story in the Book of Kings, but also mentioning Beit David. Okay, so you find references. These are big things because this is actual written records showing that this obviously was such an idea of the monarchy of King David. Could we prove conclusively the size of the empire? Brings up another question. Archaeologists ask, we've dug all over the place there, we don't find any evidence of any of this big palace complex or anything like that. Well, what's the answer to that? Sorry? Well, first of all, the Temple Mount, we haven't dug. There's a lot of places here that haven't been dug on. The whole Temple Mount you can't touch. The Arabs are destroying it now. They're digging like crazy there. God knows what they found and dumping. Okay, that's a tragedy. What's going on? There's a travesty in archaeology. And lots of places haven't been excavated because they've been inhabited. So only small sections have been excavated. But what we appreciate is because the Temple Mount and the hill of Mount Moriah is so narrow, that anyone wants to build there would have to basically clear out everything that existed before and build on top of it. So the fact that we don't find remains of Solomon's palace complex, there is stuff down there, if you look, that is dated to the first temple period, but it's very minimal. Okay, but again, it's a question of lack of evidence. Okay. So basically, what have we seen? Again, nothing was like mind-blowing. He didn't hear anything. It was like, oh, wow. Now that could change tomorrow. Tomorrow we could find, it only takes, people appreciate, it only takes one piece of evidence. Like one direct piece of evidence mentioning something, David, Solomon, an event, a document, to completely blow the whole thing to pieces. Okay? But we haven't found. You can't destroy the Bible for the lack of evidence, I can't say, you know, I'm sure in the future we will. Although I do believe that as we dig more and more, we'll come across more and more interesting things. And the evidence will be much more powerful. You should appreciate that, of course, after David and Solomon, there is no debate. You can go to England and see all kinds of external historical records supporting the biblical narrative, like the story of Hezekiah being besieged in Jerusalem by Sennacherib. You can go to the British Museum, the same place they have his walls in the palace, and you see a stone with an engraving. It says, Hezekiah, king of Jerusalem, I locked in his city like a bird in a cage. Okay, it's there. Okay, it's interesting. Sorry? Not necessarily. And by the way, he's honest enough to say they didn't capture the city, because we know he didn't. The story of the Bible, he doesn't capture the city. When it talks about Hezekiah, with that period of time, there's a lot of archaeology for that. You can see the archaeology right here, the broad wall in the old city of Jerusalem. The water system that's described, that he builds to bring the Siloam pool inside the walls of the old city from the Gihon Spring, okay? Okay. That, the plaque for where the diggers met, which is one of the most important pieces of written documentation from all of Jerusalem ever found, was found in the tunnel, carved out, broken up, unfortunately, sitting in the museum in Istanbul. Okay, but that stuff we have. No one debates. The point is not late Book of Kings after David and Solomon onward. That is something that basically everyone accepts as being more or less accurate. The point is what's going before. And, of course, the point we have to appreciate is the ramifications of what comes earlier is what's important. Because that's the stuff that Judaism is based on. Exodus from Egypt, this patriarchal narrative, Abraham. We say they're real people. Yeah, Jack. Well, first of all, if Ezra is in fact the author, as some Bible critics claim, he's the one who's putting the stories together. So the point would be that he wouldn't be able to know what was going on earlier. The Bible would contain lots of anachronistic information. I don't know if I'm answering that question.
Now, we have proof that he's fine for X number of 100 years before, so why is that a question of going back?
No, you'd expect the further back in time you go, the more anachronistic and inaccurate it will go. If you're basing on oral traditions being passed down for generations, the further back, the worse it will be. The closer to the event, the more accurate it will be. So therefore, you'd expect that when you get to Abraham, which is way, 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 way before Ezra by 13 centuries, there's no way there'd be any even kernels of truth in that. Yeah?
Didn't they find the remnants of a huge boat embedded in the mountains of
Noah's Ark. There isn't. People claim Mount Ararat. There's a giant. It's one of the things they've been looking at for years in satellite photographs. That stuff, I had never seen anything good on that. Okay, the flood, we didn't get to that. That's even before Jewish history. I'd rather not even touch on that because it's outside the topic. But that's one of, yes, many civilizations have flood stories, including South and Central Indian civilizations. But then again, if you look in the records, the fossil records, you don't see clear evidence of universal level of flooding around the world. So you have a question there. Okay, but that's pre. Okay, the flood story, I'm not even getting into that. I don't even touch that because it's really outside our topic. But basically, just to conclude a little, what we've seen. So we've seen a lot of circumstantial evidence. Okay, we haven't seen things contradicting the Bible story. We have a very strong case to show us that whoever is the author of the book clearly has information done accurately, whereas if the book was written much later in history, we should expect it to contain a huge amount of anachronisms. Now, a question was asked. I think you asked the question, right? If the Bible critics are claiming that the book is written much later, yet it doesn't contain anachronistic information, then we have a huge puzzle. How was that information passed on so accurately? Why didn't any anachronisms creep in? Anachronisms are the rule, not the exception. Okay, the Bible seems to be the exception in that case. And there is no logical answer for that. I mean, basically, based on what we know of anthropology and how traditions are passed on, to say that the Jews managed to do something that no other culture in human history managed to do, which was to accurately pass on the stories of their ancient past down to detailed information, names, migratory patterns, weights and measures, prices, with nothing anachronistic creeping in, is fantastic. Okay, I even heard a Bible critic say, I asked him to explain, if in fact it is written hundreds if not thousands of years after the events, yet there's nothing really anachronistic in there, how did they do it? And the answer was, and in my mind this is a huge leap of faith, the remarkable transmission process of the Jews. They managed to, all the detailed historical events passed down without being altered or anachronisms creeping in.
Could they say not Abrahamic
business? Not necessarily. That's different. They could say it's like the ultimate historical fiction. That's not what they're saying. Or it could be based on a character. But the important thing to focus on is two things, just to close, is one is how much subjectivity creeps in. When you see articles on archaeology in the Bible, immediately your subjectivity, objectivity antenna should be up. Who's writing it? What are they saying? Where are they coming from? A guy like Zev Herzog or Israel Finkelstein are extreme left-wing in their political thinking. They have a vested interest in undermining the historicity, because they view this as like sort of Jewish imperialism. They have another agenda going on there. It is not purely their love of archaeology and truth. You have to be very careful. A lot of anti-Semitism is involved. Even Jewish anti-Semitism is involved in attacking the Bible. Nothing that the Palestinians like to hear better than Jewish archaeologists attacking the historicity of the Bible. You never find any Muslims attacking the historicity of the Quran. They'd be get a fatwa, a religious death sentence put on them, but they never would touch it. So what we do have, sorry?
It's still a common difference, because if they do admit that it's true,
okay, that's true too. If you're going to admit that the Bible is essentially correct, then you got to start keeping the Torah. Okay. The point is, I don't want to go into what everyone's personal subjective opinions are as to why they're interpreting what they're interpreting how. We have to just be aware of A, how much subjectivity plays a part in interpretation, okay, and B, that almost all of the attacks are going to be based on lack of evidence. And when you tune and you're sensitive to those two things, and you start reading articles appearing in Newsweek and Time and New York Times, what you'll find is all the attacks are based on those two things. Nothing, no hard evidence, no contradictory evidence is coming out. Okay, and maybe that'll change when we find some other evidence one way or another. You know, I firmly believe we're going to find very soon. And somewhere, some amazing piece of evidence which is going to flip everything over, but we'll have to wait for that. So what should we be using archaeology for? Okay, now I'm not trying to, you know... raising money. It's not a waste of money. It's not a waste of money at all. I'm a big fan of it. It's a lot of fun to get involved in. If you can get a little bit of backache and sunburn, but it's actually a lot of fun to do digs. But in terms of how can we use archaeology as, in terms of, not religion, let's take off our yeshiva hats. The point is you have to realize that it has its uses and it has its misuses. The question is how to evaluate it fairly. Now, Adam Zertal, who's the head of the Department of Archaeology at Haifa University, he still has the quote, which I always end with when I talk about archaeology in the Bible, because it's the best quote, I think, fairest quote. He is not a religious Jew, but he's a person who respects the essential historicity of the text, because he's seen with his own digging, his own hands and his own eyes, how much what is described is in fact backed up. Does he say that this is proof that everything's true in the Torah? No, he doesn't believe it. He's not a religious Jew. But listen to what he says, and I think this is the fairest statement I've ever seen about using archaeology. It has become fashionable in the last decade or so, to, especially amongst a group of scholars who regard themselves as Syrio-Palestinian archaeologists, to ignore and even shun the Bible. The reason for this inclinations are various, from sociological to personal and political. After years of archaeological research, however, I believe it is impossible to explore Israel's origins without the Bible. At the same time, the research should be as objective as possible. The Bible should be used cautiously and critically, but again and again we have seen the historical value of the Bible. Again and again we have seen that an accurate memory has been preserved in its transmuted narrative, waiting to be unearthed and exposed by archaeological fieldwork and critical mind work. Thank you. Okay, guys, if you have any questions, you can... Sorry? Yeah, Rabbi Wolpe. What is he based? He's picking up on basically Israel Finkelstein and Zev Herzog. I wouldn't be surprised. Most archaeologists are not. Most archaeologists are in the middle. Most archaeologists in Israel are not religious Jews. They sound much more right-wing nowadays. Precisely, a lot has to do with the position that archaeology is taking just academically, but more it has to do with the attacks from the other side being so extreme, A, and what the Arabs are doing to like sites like the Temple Mount, just like digging it up with bulldozers and completely disregarding all of the status quo. Any site in Israel, because it was one giant archaeological site, first of all, a site like that should never be touched with heavy equipment ever, and only with the most intensive supervision of archaeologists. How are they doing it? Because because of the political implications, is afraid to touch the site, because they're afraid it's going to trigger more violence or whatever. It's been going on for a couple of years now, what's going on there. It is an absolute disaster. They're finding stuff dumped that is incredible. By the way, once you take something out of the whole, there's two things in archaeology, the item and its placement, because the placement of an item gives you the context. Okay? Once you remove it, okay, someone might want to buy it because it's a cute thing and has value. It may even have intellectual value. But once it's removed from the site, which is why archaeologists will very carefully, when they excavate, they'll slowly go down, documenting every inch of what they find, photographing it, labeling it. So you have, because the context gives you the whole clue to everything. And once you start digging up with a bulldozer, digging a huge pit, throwing it in a truck, and dumping it in the Kidron Valley, okay, archaeologists were running down there doing emergency salvage digs 2 years ago just to sift through, and they found amazing stuff. They found huge blocks of stone from the temple, I think, and all kinds of stuff all along there. Tons of stuff is being dug up.
What's the story with Dan Bahat?
A story with Dan Bahat? What about him?
What is he holding, the great mix of archaeology?
Dan Bahat is like a typical, he's a very middle-of-the-road kind of guy. I spent a lot of time studying with him. He's a funny guy. He's not religious, for sure not. I imagine he's something. He might be even somewhat anti-religious, I'm not sure. Jerusalem archaeology has been a very painful experience dealing with ultra-Orthodox Jews. But he's not a minimalist at all. He's not a minimalist. By the way, he published the single best book you ever want on Jerusalem archaeologically. It's the Jerusalem Historical Atlas of Jerusalem based on archaeology. It's like a must-own book if you're even a little bit serious about the topic. It goes to every period, every piece of archaeology. Gentlemen, thank you.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a complete listing of our cassettes, see our web store at aish.com. For a free cassette catalog, email us at voices@aish.com. or call toll-free in the U.S. 1-800-VOICES-3. Our main office is at 1 Western Wall Plaza, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.